this long-term relationship with my girlfriend crashed and burned. I had bought a video camera because I was starting to make movies of my own. That got stolen. A whole bunch of things in my life just sort of fell apart. I could have looked at that as a failure, but even at that time, I saw it as an opportunity. Like, I felt liberated by the dissolution of myself because I knew that there was some opportunity in that challenge.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Varol. This week's guest on Famous Failures is Chris Kresser. Chris is the CEO of Kresser Institute, the co-director of the California Center for Functional Medicine, and the New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Cure. He's known for his in-depth research uncovering myths and misconceptions of modern medicine and providing natural health solutions with proven results. Chris was named one of the 100 most influential people in health and fitness by greatest.com, and his blog is one of the top-ranked natural health websites in the world. He recently launched Kresser Institute, an organization dedicated to reinventing healthcare and reversing chronic disease by training healthcare practitioners in functional and evolutionary medicine. In the interview, we covered quite a bit of ground. Chris begins with his background and shares with us his personal experience with chronic illness that led him to pursue the path he is currently on. We first talk about what functional medicine is, and then we talk about how functional medicine can benefit patients by focusing on unrooting the underlying cause of a problem, as opposed to simply attacking the symptom, which is what much of what conventional medicine does. And the insights that Chris shares there, I think, highly applicable outside of the world of functional medicine and beyond that world to our personal and professional lives as well. We then switch over to Chris's failures and his experience with being hit with what he calls a cosmic 2x4 that ended up being a blessing in disguise. If you'd like to follow Chris's work, I highly encourage you to sign up for his emails at chriskresser.com, where he shares his insights on health, nutrition, productivity, overcoming technology addiction, and living a full and rewarding life. Before I turn things over to Chris, as always, if you've been enjoying these episodes, please take just a minute to rate the podcast on Google Play or iTunes and subscribe on whatever platform that you might be listening on. In addition, if you'd like to keep in touch with me, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian, that goes out every Thursday morning and shares with you 4 to 5 things. It could be articles, it could be tools, it could be things to try, it could be quotes, with the intention of challenging conventional wisdom and changing the way that we view the world. You can sign up for that in one of two ways. You can go to my website, ozanvarol.com. That's O-Z-A-N, V as in Victor, A-R-O-L.com, and just dropping your email address there. And if you do that, you'll also get my free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. In addition, as long as you're not driving, you can also text my first name, Ozan, that's O-Z-A-N, to 345-345 to sign up for my email list and receive my free ebook as well. Without further ado, I give you Chris Kresser. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Chris, welcome to Famous Failures.
Ozan, thanks for having me.
I've been really looking forward to this conversation for some time now. As I mentioned before we hit record here, I had heard of your name from my doctor several times, and then you generously circulated one of my articles to your newsletter list, which gave us the opportunity to connect. So thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
In your latest book, Unconventional Medicine, you talk about how your own personal struggles with chronic and complex illness inspired you to pursue the path you're on today. So for those listeners who are not familiar with you and your work, can you walk us through what happened?
Sure. In my early 20s, I quit my job, sold everything I owned, and took off to travel the world. I was feeling dissatisfied with my life at that point and wanting to explore a different path. And one of the places that I ended up was in Indonesia on a small island called Sumbawa. I'm a lifelong surfer, and that's Indonesia is kind of a mecca for surfers. So I was staying in a small village there on Sumbawa, surfing this spot called Lakey Peak. If you have any surfers in your audience, they might know where that is. And unbeknownst to me at the time, there was a big pool of stagnant water where cows were kind of milling around and defecating. And they dug a trench between that and the river mouth there. So all of that polluted water went out into the surf break. And a few of us that were staying there got really ill with several different parasite infections. And I was, you know, vomiting, diarrhea, delirious, fever, chills. Don't really remember much of the 3 days. I was pretty with the classic tropical illness symptoms. And the acute phase of that passed relatively quickly. I had an Australian who was staying in the village, had some antibiotics that I took, and then I continued to travel. From there, I went to the Maldives in India and then South Africa. But after a few months, the symptoms started to come back with a vengeance and evolve into a more complex chronic condition. And I had been on the road for about, I think, 9 or 10 months, and originally intended to travel for a couple of years. And I ended up coming back after just under a year because I was so sick. And saw a bunch of doctors initially, you know, conventional doctors, and they suspected it was a parasite infection. So they prescribed antibiotics even without doing any testing, and, you know, took a bunch of antibiotics and would get better temporarily and then get worse. And after seeing about 5 doctors, I started to wonder if just taking antibiotics over and over again was the best path, because even then we knew something about, you know, we didn't know what we know now about the gut microbiome and how important it is, but where there were already starting to be some questions. And just empirically, I knew, you know, it's that classic saying, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result is insanity, right? So I started to reach beyond conventional medicine and see practitioners of Chinese medicine, Ayurveda. I started to do different diets. I became a macrobiotic vegan at one point. I was vegetarian. I did grain-free diets. You know, I took tons of different supplements, and time continued to pass and I continued to be sick. My journey then took me into, you know, I started to consider the psychological, psycho-spiritual, and emotional possibilities that could be contributing to my illness. I moved to the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, which is a kind of personal development retreat center that started back in the 60s. And I spent a couple of years there. And, you know, I'm trying to give you the most abbreviated version I can. It took about 10 years for me to recover my health. And, you know, we can talk about what it was that made the biggest difference. But once that happened, along the way, people who had witnessed my journey had started to ask me questions about what I had learned and how I had recovered my health, because they saw how sick I was. I mean, in the darkest period, you know, I was in my mid to late 20s and I was basically incapacitated. I would spend, you know, large parts of the day curled up in a ball on the floor in pain. I, at one point, had a kind of complete emotional nervous breakdown and ended up in the hospital just from sheer exhaustion and, you know, sleep deprivation and being in pain for so long. And being in my mid to late 20s at this point and having no idea what my future was, or even if I had a future, and the life that I had imagined for myself completely disintegrating before my eyes, you know, it was pretty rough. It was a dark night of the soul for sure. And then as I recovered my health, people started to ask, you know, hey, what did you learn in that process? And can you share it with me? And so organically, I started to move in the direction of doing that. And then at some point, decided to formalize that with going back to school to study Chinese medicine and acupuncture, and then eventually functional medicine. And here I am today.
There's no urgency quite like getting hit with a chronic disease yourself or having a loved one suffer from it for people to take action, right? So since you mentioned it, I mean, I have to ask, what was the thing that made the biggest difference for you?
Well, of course, that's a question I get often, and it would be great if I could just say it was one thing, but it wasn't. And that's kind of how life and illness is. A paleo type diet was a big turning point for me. And I stumbled on it kind of accidentally. I didn't even know that there was such a thing as a paleo type of diet. I just arrived at it by experimentation. I found a book called Nourishing Traditions, which is Weston A. Price approach to nutrition, which was mostly just very nutrient dense, you know, animal products, vegetables, some fermented foods like sauerkraut and kefir and bone broth and a lot of gut healing foods, but they also included grains and legumes if they were soaked and properly prepared, which I found didn't work for me. So I removed those, you know, voila, I was on a paleo type of diet. You know, this was me coming from being a macrobiotic vegan. So this was definitely not an ideological choice. It was a, you know, it came directly out of my experience of what worked for me. So I would say that was a big step along the way for me, but also the exploring the psycho-spiritual and emotional roots of what was going on for me. I don't think it's as simple as I got parasites and that was the full cause, because I think if you took 10 people and exposed them to the same exact thing that I was exposed to, you would see 10 different scenarios unfold over time. And that would be based on the person's genes, their gene expression, their health status when they were exposed, their life circumstances, and a whole bunch of other factors that would determine the outcome there. And in fact, I stayed in touch with some people who were in the village at that time, and that's exactly what happened. Some people recovered quite quickly and got over it and went on to, you know, resume the life they thought they were going to live. And then other people were laid out for maybe a year or so, and then they recovered. And then there were a couple others who were kind of more on my trajectory. So as I mentioned in response to your first question, that trip for me was a kind of journey of personal exploration. It was prompted by dissatisfaction with the path I had chosen when I graduated from college. And part of that trip was about me discovering myself and a different path. I don't believe that everything happens for a reason. I think that implies way too much control. I don't believe that we have that much control over our lives in the universe. But I do believe that we have a choice about how we respond to what happens. And we can either resist it and struggle against it and try to manipulate circumstances to fit our notion of reality, or we can respond, accept what has happened and respond appropriately and, you know, be open to whatever that event was, has to teach us. And so that kind of journey for me, I think, really informed my healing process and what my life ended up looking like.
That's such great advice. You don't get to control what happens to you, but you do get to control how you respond. For those who are listening, I recently returned to a book by Viktor Frankl, who is an Austrian psychologist and a survivor of Auschwitz. And the book is called A Man's Search for Meaning, where he essentially makes the same argument. It's such powerful advice. Now, many people, though, in your position, Chris, may have succumbed to their fate, right? You had seen 5 doctors in the conventional healthcare system. They gave you a bunch of different opinions, put you on antibiotics, and they didn't work. But you were not content with the status quo. You kept experimenting, trying different types of medicine, trying different types of diets, eliminating items from your diets to see what impact that had on your health. I'm curious, I mean, is there something in your upbringing or maybe the education you receive that drives that discontent with the status quo and encourages experimentation?
You know, both of my parents went to UC Berkeley in the 60s. They were just before the Mario Savio protests and the movement that most people think of when they think of Berkeley in the 60s. They were a little bit older than that, but they were on the edge of that. And I think it definitely influenced their perspective on life and their thought process. They're both critical thinkers. They're not the type of people to just accept, you know, what they're told and what the prevailing status quo is. And I think I learned that from them. And I also had some great teachers growing up that challenged me to do that. And for whatever reason, that just seems to be my nature as well. I also went to UC Berkeley. I grew up in a relatively homogenous, you know, middle-class community in Southern California. I was actually being recruited to play basketball in college, and I went to UC Davis to check out their team and also to Santa Clara University. And when I was deciding what to do for college, I kind of realized I had a decision to make there where I could continue at UC Davis and Santa Clara, which were also relatively homogenous schools, and play basketball, which just wasn't really calling to me. And on the way back from that trip, my parents, I think somewhat sneakily, just suggested that we stop by UC Berkeley and take a tour of the campus and walk around. And when I did that, I just intuitively had a strong hit that going there would expose me to things and open, you know, my horizons in a way that going to UC Davis or Santa Clara didn't. And that turned out to be absolutely true, both in terms of the school itself and the curriculum there. I ended up designing my own major, which is a very Berkeley thing to do. And they, you know, they offer that program. But then extracurricularly, I was exposed to a lot of different concepts and ideas that I probably wouldn't have been elsewhere. And I think also some of it is just genetic and biological, or just my nature. There's kind of some family lore where when I was 4 years old and my mom was telling me to do something, I responded, "Mom, you're not the boss of me. I'm the boss of me." That goes back pretty deeply into my childhood, just being strong-willed and determined and not being willing to give up when I had a goal in mind. And the goal in this case was twofold. I think it was to recover my health, but it was also to find a path in life that felt more congruent with who I am and what I want, you know, the impact I wanted to have and the way I wanted to experience myself and life.
You're now the either the second or the third guest I've had on the show who designed their own major, who then ended up being a very independent thinker. So I don't know which way the causation arrow points, if it's the designing of the major that breeds this sort of thinking, or if it's the, you know, the first principles thinkers tend to gravitate towards. Yeah, exactly. Correlation or causation. So then the path that you started walking on eventually led you to the forefront of functional medicine. For the listeners who don't know what functional medicine is, and you already indirectly answered this question, but I'd love to get it out more directly. How do you define functional medicine, and how is it different from conventional medicine?
Well, I usually start with an analogy because it's just so easy to get. If you have a rock in your shoe and it's making your foot hurt, you go to a conventional doctor, usually the prescription will be for ibuprofen or a painkiller, and that would certainly alleviate the pain. But in functional medicine, what we do is, you know, we would ask you a bunch of questions and do some testing and find out that you had a rock in your shoe, and then we would suggest that you take off your shoe and dump it out. It's a simplistic analogy, but it actually really does get to the root of the difference. So that if you think of disease on the spectrum, where on the left you have perfect health and on the right you have death, conventional medicine really is set up to intervene at the far right end of that spectrum. It basically is focused on managing disease after it has occurred, mostly by using drugs to suppress symptoms or sometimes surgery. Whereas functional medicine is oriented around preventing and reversing disease by addressing the root causes of that condition. So if we use irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, as an example, it's now the second leading cause of people missing work. It's epidemic. In conventional medicine, all of the treatments for IBS are focused on suppressing symptoms. So you might get an analgesic for the pain. You might get an antispasmodic for the bloating. You might get something like Imodium if you have diarrhea, or a promotility drug if you have constipation. You might get an antidepressant for the anxiety and depression that can be associated with IBS. And those drugs can be helpful, and they, you know, we certainly don't want to, I mean, get providing relief to patients is important. But none of those drugs actually address the root cause of the condition. And in many cases, taking those drugs actually ends up necessitating more drugs because they have unintended effects. So, you know, an antidepressant could cause weight gain and constipation. And then, you know, so that might actually necessitate a promotility drug, or maybe eventually a drug like metformin because, you know, a patient has developed diabetes. And this happens all the time. This is really kind of the trajectory that somebody can get on if they take that path. In functional medicine, the approach to IBS would be different. there's lots of studies in the peer-reviewed literature that link things like bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine or fungal overgrowth or undiagnosed parasite infections or conditions like H. pylori infection that can happen in the stomach or problems with the gut-brain axis, like the communication between the brain and the vagus nerve and the GI tract, heavy metal toxicity, many other potential underlying causes that can contribute to IBS. So we would do a lot of testing up front to find out if any of those conditions are present, those pathologies are present, and we would address those pathologies in the hope that the patient we can actually cure and reverse IBS rather than just manage it with drugs. Now, that's not always possible. You know, this is, of course, real life. So we can't always do that, but it's certainly the best starting place. You know, drugs may become necessary at some point. In functional medicine, they're never, or rarely, I should say, the first option. You know, we try to address the root cause of the problem first and foremost, because that leads to much better outcomes in the vast majority of cases.
Sure. And then, of course, the other problem with treating the symptom, I guess treating the symptom gives us the satisfaction of doing something about the problem. But as you said, it may actually, it often does leave the underlying cause intact, and it could mask the underlying cause and potentially exacerbate it.
Yeah, very often it can make the underlying cause worse, which is the irony of the situation.
The point about symptom versus cause, looking at it more broadly, I think applies outside of functional medicine and even medicine as well. I mean, I speak before corporate audiences frequently, and one of the things I observe is this problem in the business world of attacking the symptom, because symptoms are visible, right? So if a manager makes a bad decision, that manager can be demoted or fired. But often what the business is doing is actually attacking the symptom and leaving, say, if it's like, you know, a culture of conformity, leaving that underlying cause intact. So I wonder if there are any specific strategies that you use in functional medicine for uncovering the cause that might apply more broadly outside of that context to, say, the corporate world, or really our personal lives as well.
I would say spending more time on diagnosis up front and being willing to invest more in that process is a really key aspect of functional medicine that could translate into other areas. You know, if you imagine in conventional medicine, the average visit with a primary care provider is between 8 and 12 minutes today, which leaves barely enough time to say hello, you know, ask you about your symptoms and prescribe a medication that is based on an assumption that's made there about what's going on and that's largely designed to control the symptoms. In the functional medicine model, initial appointment with a provider is usually a minimum of an hour and sometimes an hour and a half. And in fact, the way that we structure it at our clinic is we do a 30-minute initial video consult with the patient where we ask, you know, very detailed questions about their primary complaints, what their goals are, their background, their history. And then we order a bunch of tests before we even see the patient. And then they come in person for their initial appointment, which is between an hour and 75 or 90 minutes, depending on the clinician. But when they walk in that door, we already have all of the test results back and we've already reviewed them. So we have a very good idea of what's happening with that patient. And that initial appointment can be so much more productive because we've done stool testing to check the status of their microbiome. And if they have any gut infections or dysbiosis, we've done a comprehensive blood chemistry panel, which is much more in depth than what you get at a, you know, typical doctor's visit that looks at blood sugar levels, thyroid, you know, metabolic markers, nutrient status, immune status, and a whole bunch of other things that can help us to detect the early signs of disease before it's progressed to, you know, full-fledged disease. So, you know, preventing a problem before it occurs is much easier than addressing it after it's occurred. That's a key principle of functional medicine, and also just I think a wise approach to, you know, solving problems. Spending more time and being willing to commit more resources up front to getting clear on what the problem is and what the causes of the problem is, I think, a key principle. And, you know, just on a personal example, my organization has grown really quickly over the years as we start to, you know, we have training program for doctors and also just launched one for health coaches. And so we've needed to hire more people and our organization has grown. And in that process, there have been some growing pains. And we hired an organization called Nobel that works to help companies become more adaptive. And one of the reasons that I was drawn to them is that I could see in their book and also in the talking with them that they took more of a functional medicine approach to addressing issues with companies and helping them to grow and scale. And before we had our first half day workshop with them, they talked to everybody in the company to find out what their pain points were, you know, what was working, what wasn't working, to essentially diagnose the problem. So that when we had that first 4-day workshop, they were prepared with steps that we could take that would actually address those problems. So I think that's a really good example of what we're talking about.
That's amazing. And that's so rare in this world of move fast and break things. You know, we're all looking right for a quick fix, the right answer. But that approach is antithetical to unmasking the underlying cause, because usually if we act fast, the first thing we attack ends up being the symptom and not the cause.
No, I will say, just to sort of play devil's advocate to myself and what we're talking about here, I recently read Steven Pinker's book, Enlightenment Now. Not sure if you're familiar with it, where he argues that things are a lot better than we think they are.
Right.
You know, we tend to have this kind of confirmation bias or recency bias where we think the world's going to hell in a handbasket and we're living in a time that's kind of apocalyptic. And he uses a lot of data and research to methodically show that that's, you know, objectively untrue, and that actually by almost any measure, our life is better than any of our predecessors' lives if we accept his measures for quality of life. But one thing really stood out to me, and this is why I love to read widely and not just within health. In fact, I rarely read books about health. I generally tend to read biographies and other nonfiction books like this. At one point, I don't know if he coined this phrase or if it comes from somewhere else, but he talked about root causism, and in a kind of pejorative way. And that, of course, stood out to me. And I have an initial reaction of like, hey, you know, that's, you know, I wasn't immediately amenable to hearing what he had to say about that. But of course, I like to challenge my, you know, as soon as I get over that initial reaction, I like to challenge my beliefs and read other perspectives. And I think that's healthy. And so what he was talking about was that when problems are extremely complex, as many economic and social and environmental problems are, for example, that it can become difficult, if not impossible, to identify the root causes just because of how complex they really are. And that in those cases, actually addressing some of the symptoms can be one of the more effective ways of sort of tracing back to the root cause and nudging the system to improve and even self-heal. He didn't say that. I'm kind of extending that to health. But if we use a health analogy, like I treat a lot of patients who are extremely sick. You know, these are people who, like myself, had been sick for 10 years, have seen 50 different doctors, have done every special diet you can possibly imagine, have, you know, cupboards full of supplements, and they're still sick. And they come to me sometimes, in some cases, doing that functional medicine investigation where we are really searching for the root cause of the problem. And we find, you know, usually more than one cause, and we address those causes and the patient gets better. In other cases, that investigative approach is not very fruitful. And what we end up doing there is kind of starting from the outside in and working backwards, where we start just working with them on the basics like stress management, you know, trying to help them improve their sleep, making some small improvements in their diet, making some small tweaks in their physical activity, helping them reach out to get more social support, all of the things that we know contribute to health. And we don't actually focus myopically or obsessively on trying to discover the root cause if we haven't, you know, made progress in that way. And we really take the, I guess, you know, the approach that Steven Pinker advocated for in that book. And sometimes that can actually be more effective. So just personally, I'm trying to keep an open mind about the different approaches that can be useful depending on the circumstances.
I love that. And I love that you read outside of your field as well. That's, I think, another rare trait. I think Einstein called that combinatorial play, where the mixing and matching of ideas from different disciplines can really, that's the root cause or the root instigator of creativity and originality. So I'd love to switch gears a little bit and talk about failure. And I'm going to quote from an email that you sent to me just yesterday on the issue. And you said, "I'm one of those people that doesn't think in terms of success and failure, at least not in a binary fashion." So I love that quote. And I wanted to just get your thoughts and some more context on what that means and why you don't think in terms of success and failure in a binary way.
I'm not sure I can really answer the question why, because that gets to, you asked earlier, is it genetics? Is it biology? Is it early childhood experiences? I'm not sure why, but I can tell you what my current perspective is. I think that if I look back on my life, and even when, I was working, when I got out of college, I was working in we have a family business. My dad was in advertising for many years, and then he started an IMAX film production company. And my brother and I started a TV channel together. And, it was just sort of the path that was expected in some way of me, and that was easy and kind of the default path. And I was good at it, but I was unhappy. So, within a relatively short period of time, and my early 20s, I'd bought a house and I was like on this fast track. And within a relatively short period of time, this long-term relationship with my girlfriend crashed and burned. I had bought a video camera because I was considering, I was starting to make movies of my own. That got stolen. A whole bunch of things in my life just sort of stopped and fell apart. I could have looked at that as a failure. I mean, and certainly it was really difficult and painful, but even at that time, I saw it as an opportunity. Like I felt liberated by the dissolution of myself at that time, because I knew that there was some opportunity in that challenge and I was ready for it because I was not happy with the direction that my life was going in. I think I mentioned in the email, I sometimes refer to that as being hit by the cosmic 2x4,
right?
Or in the Zen tradition, it's getting, smacked by the stick. It's a wake up call. I went off and I started traveling and I was in this blissful state. I mean, I was surfing some of the most beautiful locations in the world. I did a 30-day meditation retreat in Thailand in the jungle, doing long meditation retreats in Australia, and was like on this kind of this other plane and thinking that, things were just amazing and this is it. And, I've got it all figured out. And then that happened. And, I got incredibly sick in that village in Sumbawa. And, it was like, okay, what about this? Is this also included in your conception of life and what life has in store for you? And during that period, I would say within the first couple of years, it became clear to me that, again, this was a life-changing experience. It was incredibly difficult. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. As I said before, there were times where I didn't know if I was even going to survive it. And I was, incredibly scared and afraid and, immense pain. And yet I also was aware somehow that there was a big opportunity there and that I was being kind of reshaped by that experience. And that was in many ways a kind of rite of passage that I had to go through. In other words, my will was so strong and my determination and my kind of the trajectory that I had been on that I felt that I was supposed to take because of how strong my will was, that path was so strong that it almost took that kind of violent and brutal experience to send me in a different direction. And I knew that about myself. So it's hard for me to look back on my life from where I am now and see, okay, well, was it a failure that I didn't succeed in my, initial role as a television and film executive? And then was it a success that I was able to recover from that and go in a different direction? And then was it a failure that I got sick and wasn't able to recover for 10 years? But was it ultimately a success that I was? It's just hard to see it that way for me at this point. It's really more of a series of things that happen and my responses to those things.
Did you come to the realization while this was happening to you, or did this something that happened to you in retrospect? So looking at the events in retrospect, they look like a or they are, not just look, but they are a blessing in disguise? Or did you actually realize that they may be a blessing in disguise while you were going through them?
Both. So, you know, initially I was in the first, you know, several months, I was just feeling angry and upset, you know, like, why is this happening to me? I was feeling like it was unfair and I didn't understand what was going on. And I wish someone could just tell me what to do to get better. And it was all kind of external, you know, like, this is a problem that I'm just going to solve and I'm going to move on. Within a year, I would say, it became clear to me that there was something else happening. And as I mentioned earlier, I even, you know, I moved to the Esalen Institute in Big Sur and lived there for a couple of years because I realized that there was more to it than just the parasites. And there was something deeply transformative happening. And I needed to actually give that some space and learn some new tools for how to explore and work with that, which I did at Esalen. And I'm very grateful for, because it was clear by then that it wasn't just, you know, something to get rid of, basically, which is kind of how I initially conceived of it. And in working with patients, I really try to invite them to consider those possibilities. Again, you know, not to accept or surrender. I mean, I think there's an important difference that took me a long time to figure out between acceptance and submission. So by acceptance, I learned to understand that as just accepting what actually is, you know, just objectively what is to be there. It doesn't mean you agree with it. It doesn't mean you're not going to, in that very next moment, work to change it, but it means that you do recognize what is. And I think acceptance is actually a precondition to change. You can't actually change something if you don't accept it, because if you don't accept it, you don't see it clearly for what it is. And so it took me many years to learn that difference and negotiate that. And with my patients, I try to reflect that and help invite the possibility of seeing what they're going through as an opportunity for growth and evolution, while continuing to try to address the physical aspect of the disease and to recover.
That distinction between acceptance and submission too, I think, harkens back to something you mentioned earlier in our discussion, which is this idea that you can't change what happens to you, but you can change how you react to it. So you have to accept the external circumstances, but you don't have to submit to them. So you can change the way that you react because you're in control of that.
It's a crucial thing for anyone who's dealing with chronic illness to learn, because if, you know, just to use an example, if you wake up and you're having a really terrible day, accepting that means just tuning in to your body and accepting, okay, this is, you know, I'm having a hard day. And so how can I respond appropriately to that? You know, instead of pushing myself and acting as if I'm not having a hard day, maybe I restructure my day so I can get more rest and, you know, I can actually nurture and take care of myself. And that doesn't mean, again, that you're not still then thinking about what can I do to make sure I have a better day the next day. Definitely keep that in mind. But the very nature of accepting the current circumstances and changing your day so you can get more rest and take care of yourself means that you probably will have a better day the next day. Whereas if you had pushed and not accepted what was going on, that then becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy where you know, you'll end up in the same place again. So that's a more concrete example of how it plays out with health.
We're almost at the end of our time here, but there's one final substantive question I'd love to ask you before we tell people where they can find you. When you challenge the status quo has a way of resisting, of pushing back, especially the people who are invested in the status quo. And since you're at the forefront, to use the title of your latest book, of unconventional medicine, what challenges have you encountered? And I'm sure there have been many, but maybe you can pick one or two that you've encountered along the way in trying to implement this alternative unconventional take on medicine.
There's challenges from all corners, as you might imagine. In the conventional medical world, there's the idea that functional medicine is not evidence-based, which is completely untrue, and I address that in my book. There are a lot of powers that be that are actually invested in maintaining the status quo. You know, it's not necessarily in the interests of big pharma, for example, to become more integrated with functional medicine, because drugs are you know, not as much of a, they don't play as important a role in that perspective. I think most doctors that I've come across are actually very much aware of the shortcomings of conventional medicine and acutely feel them themselves and actually suffer from them. Most doctors go into medicine because they want to help people, and they feel like in their, you know, in the current system that that becomes very difficult with the way that it's set up. So I found that most doctors are quite open to these concepts, but of course there are some who feel threatened by them or are not open to new ideas. And so we get some resistance there. And then with patients and people in general, I'd say, you know, most people are really excited to learn about these concepts, and they know intuitively that this is the right path. You know, most, if I use that analogy with the rock and the shoe, people get it right away. And they're frustrated that when they go to their doctor, the only thing that's offered is a medication. They know that that's not the best path, and they want a different solution, but it's not available in those short appointments. Now, having said that, and having trained many, many physicians in functional and other medical practitioners in this approach, it's also true as a nation, and I would say this is true in other industrialized countries, we've been trained to become passive recipients of medication. That's what qualifies as healthcare in this country. And so a lot of doctors have complained to me that, hey, this is great, I believe in this, but it's like pulling teeth to get my patients to change their diet, change their lifestyle. You know, to be fair, that's certainly true. If you look at the statistics on what people are eating and physical activity and sleep and all of this stuff, we have some challenges that we need to overcome. So all of that to me is just expected. Like you said, it doesn't faze me because I completely expect it when you're trying to work for a paradigm change that you're going to meet that kind of, you know, denial and resistance before that becomes the new default mode.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for a fascinating conversation, and not just on insights on functional medicine, but really a lot of the principles and ideas that you talked about apply generally to our personal and professional lives as well. So I certainly really appreciated it, and I'm sure our audience will as well. If people want to find out more about you, where can they find you?
Best place is just my website, chriskresser.com. And you mentioned, it sounds like you're on the email list, Ozan.
Yes.
I send out emails on a variety of topics, not just functional medicine and nutrition and wellness, but also things like overcoming technology addiction and the psycho-spiritual and emotional roots of illness and just living a more full and rewarding life in the modern world. So that's probably the best place to learn more.
And I can vouch for the quality of Chris's newsletter. I'm very liberal with the unsubscribe button, but it's one of the the handful of newsletters that I read religiously. So I encourage everyone to check it out. Once again, Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ozan. It's been a pleasure.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time.